So this talk is on the problem of immateriality and the concept of immateriality that we use. Philosophers spend a lot of time talking about whether there are immaterial things and whether the mind is immaterial. This is one of the big problems in philosophy of mind, or whether consciousness is immaterial. And I think one of the problems with the discussion and the way it's developed is that we haven't actually spent a lot of time thinking about what exactly we mean by immateriality. So the talk is not really going to be about making a case for whether the mind is immaterial or material. It's not going to be really entering into that debate, but it's going to be focusing on the question of what exactly we are asking about when we ask the question, is the mind immaterial? What do we think immateriality is, and what are the implications for claiming that something is immaterial? So we're going to be looking at the hidden assumptions behind the more familiar debates rather than getting into the debate itself. So in the first section of the talk, I'm going to be talking about what I think is the unconscious kind of concept of immateriality that motivates our debates. I'm going to call it the spooky body view of immateriality. I think that's the view that people have in mind when they're asking the question of whether things are immaterial. And this view has had considerable philosophical influence, so it really deserves to be investigated. And in the second section, I'm going to sketch an alternative view, which I take to be maybe have its own problems in a very different way, but I think is not problematic in the specific ways that the spooky body view of immateriality is problematic. And that view is going to be represented by the great medieval philosopher Thomas Aquinas, after whom the Thomistic Institute is named. And so this paper, it's not going to be my goal to convince you that mind is immaterial, but merely to show how impoverished the concept of immateriality is that we just instinctively bring to the table, what a replacement for that concept might look like, and sort of work out a little bit the details of how Aquinas fleshes out that view. But it would be a shame if we didn't see at least a little bit of how Aquinas argues for the mind's immateriality. So at the end of the talk, I'm going to run through one of his arguments, which I think is one that's very rarely talked about, but maybe one of his most interesting arguments for the mind's immateriality. All right, so let's begin then by considering some portrayals of what I want to call the spooky body concept of immateriality. And what better place to turn for illustrations of this concept than to the ghost-obsessed Victorian era? So in Charles Dickens' Christmas Carol, we find this masterfully witty description of the ghost of Jacob Marley. Dickens writes, "The same face, the very same, Marley, in his pigtail, usual waistcoat, tights, and boots, the tassels on the ladder bristling like his pigtail and his coat skirts, and the hair upon his head. His body was transparent, so that Scrooge, observing him and looking through his waistcoat, could see the two buttons on the coat behind. Scrooge had often heard it said that Marley had no bowels, but he had never believed it until now. No, nor did he believe it even now, though he looked the phantom through and through and saw it standing before him." And we notice that the ghost of Marley behaves with great propriety according to all the ghostly conventions. The laws governing the interaction among bodies appear to have no purchase on him. He passes through locked doors, he disappears into thin air, he floats out through the window, and yet Dickens imagines him in all other respects as being something quasi-bodily, transparent to be sure as befitting a ghost, but a body all the same. He's extended in space, he moves across the room, he has a whole composed of ghostly parts, characterized by the same, very same shapes and textures as Marley's living body. He is, it appears, a kind of non-bodily body, one that is spookily both like and unlike normal bodies. And Dickens is not unaware of the metaphysical tensions here. In fact, he positively revels in these tensions. So here's another quote. Can you sit down? Asked Scrooge, looking doubtfully at him. He didn't know whether a ghost so transparent might find himself in a condition to take a chair, and felt that in the event of its being impossible, it might involve the necessity of an embarrassing explanation. But the ghost sat down on the opposite side of the fireplace as if it were quite used to it. So thank goodness for that. Ghost sits in chair, embarrassing explanation averted. Great, problem solved. But what Dickens captures here is our ingrained imaginative tendency to imagine immateriality as a kind of anomalous materiality. We can't help but imagining immaterial entities as material bodies, except less substantial, as emphasized by their transparency and inability to be embraced. And they thwart as much as possible our expectations about how bodies should behave under normal circumstances. And that's emphasized by their ability to materialize out of or dematerialize into thin air, pass directly through solid structures, float, etc. And we see the same sort of things, if you're familiar with Homer, Homeric shades behave in just the same sort of, they have the same sort of properties. So this isn't just Dickens, it's a relatively, it's spread all over the literature. And such spooky bodies are not merely confined to the poetic imagination. We find them wandering around in broad daylight in our philosophical precincts also. So in Consciousness Explained, Daniel Dennett asserts that defenders of a non-physicalist account of mind are forced to attribute to the immaterial mind two competing characteristics, and he thinks this is what makes the view incoherent. Unlike a material thing, the mind, that supposedly immaterial mind, permeates the body. But like a material thing, it is able to interact with the body. So because I think, I'm able to move my arms and things. And we notice that's exactly the same way of thinking about immateriality that we saw in Dickens. And indeed, Dennett draws an explicit comparison to the comic strip Casper the Ghost, who's able to catch a falling towel despite being able to go through a wall. And I think this is quite a widespread way of thinking about immateriality, and I would submit that a lot of us who have grown up with the concept of angels, the immaterial soul, God, when we imagine immaterial substances, this is typically how we tend to default to a kind of portrayal, an imaginative portrayal of what immateriality is. And this view is the one that I want to call the spooky body approach. So it has the following three features, and maybe I put that on the handout. First, the notion of immateriality that's at work here is basically a notion of weirdly behaving materiality, in which certain features of material bodies are altered and disrupted, especially those pertaining to mass, so weight or impenetrability. Second, this negative characteristic of masslessness tends to veer in our imagination into some kind of positive feature of immaterial being, a kind of airy thinness or transparency or penetrability or fluidity of form. Third, I think this is very important when we're distinguishing this perspective from the one that Aquinas is going to present us. The spooky body view detaches immateriality from mental activity. So a spooky body need not be cognitive. It need not be a thinker. So we see this all over, again, literature. Nobody raises any sort of doubts about the coherence of the idea of a ghost ship or Macbeth's phantom dagger, right? You can have spooky non-cognitive objects just as much as you can have thinkers, and we'll see why this is important later. So now let's suppose we're all assuming the spooky body model of immateriality, as I think we tend to default to unless we have an alternative option. And so what would it mean on that assumption when we ask the question, is the mind material or immaterial? Well, notice that on the spooky body view, we're starting, when we ask that question, with two categories: materiality and immateriality. And both of them are filled in categories. They're contentful. We have some idea of what the properties are that are associated with each kind. But one of these kinds is familiar. We have lots of experience with material things. The other is not familiar. We have no experience of immaterial things that have these kinds of spooky body properties. And so a prominent historian of medieval philosophy, Bob Pasnow, writes, and this is in defense of the notion of immaterial being, "It seems to me we can most effectively capture the notion of an immaterial realm of entities by allowing for a variety of possible ways in which the world might be, such that if there were entities like that, it would be right to think of the world as carved up into two kinds, the familiar material kind and a distinct weird kind of entity, so different from what we're familiar with as to go into a fundamentally different category of being." So notice what that means for the question, is the mind material or immaterial? It means that the question amounts to asking this: which of these categories does the mind inhabit? Is it the familiar, comfortable, normal one? Or is it the weird one, the one that's not empirically accessible and that has all of these very strange, spooky properties associated with it? And we notice that the procedure here is that we first posit a set of spooky properties out of explanatory emergency, even though we haven't experienced anything with those properties. Then we construct a concept of immateriality as the stuff that has those properties. And then we ask, could the mind be the kind of thing that's made out of this stuff or not? And we can already see why this approach doesn't sound very promising. It gets even worse. Recall that third characteristic of the spooky body view, namely that in imagining immaterial entities as weird bodies, we give ourselves no reason to think that an immaterial thing has to be a thinker. A chunk of spooky stuff could be a lifeless, inanimate object. But if we get into the habit of thinking all of the reality that there is could be a kind of lifeless stuff, whether it's the normal kind or the spooky kind, and we map that onto certain interesting developments in the history of philosophy of mind that I'm not going to go into, but we could talk about them and their importance in the Q&A, then we can't help treating the mind, I think, as a kind of producer of consciousness, which is a kind of mechanism that projects consciousness from the background. And then when we're asking, is the mind immaterial or material, then we're asking the question, is the mechanism projecting consciousness, is that spooky stuff, or is it normal stuff, right? And we might ask, well then, why would we ever say it was spooky stuff? And the reason that's given in this kind of argumentation then is to make the case, well, the normal stuff can't explain the projection of consciousness, so we need to posit this other kind of weird being in order to fill the gap. And that puts us in an awkward position in terms of defending the immateriality of mind, because it looks like we've kind of cooked up some kind of immaterial being exclusively just to fill a kind of explanatory gap. Right. So from that perspective, then, it begins to look as though asserting that the mind is immaterial looks like an admission of defeat. And whether we think the mind is immaterial or not, I think it's important to keep in mind just how high the cost is of approaching immateriality that way. It puts us in the position of saying the mind is immaterial as the result of not being able to say anything about it in terms of the categories that are familiar to us, and we put it into this other group of things that we don't really understand, but we've never experienced, but we feel forced to do it. Okay. So as you can see, I think the spooky body view offers a picture of immateriality that is low on credibility. But luckily, there's another way of thinking about immateriality that I think is available to us from the history of philosophy. It's something that has, I think, been largely forgotten or lost to interpretation. And one of my projects is actually to recover this view, which is essentially a kind of view of mind, from the history of philosophy, and particularly from Thomas Aquinas, who is one of its main medieval proponents. So what follows is not only an attempt to sketch an alternative picture of immateriality, but to reconstruct the whole picture that has gone missing from our philosophical discourse. And I realize that people probably have different levels of familiarity with Aquinas, so I'm going to try to stay on the most, I'm going to try and formulate this in the most basic way, but we're unavoidably going to run into some technical material, but we'll try and sort that out and make it as clear as possible. And again, we can clarify anything that's not clear in the Q&A. Okay, so in discussing Aquinas' notion of immateriality as self-manifestation, I'm going to be using the terminology of intellect, which goes back to the Latin intellectus, which translates to the Greek nous. I'm going to use the language of intellect instead of mind for the following reason. Aquinas' theory of mind is quite complex. So sometimes when thinking about the history of philosophy of mind, we talk about how Descartes introduces a kind of flattened view of mind, where mental activities are just all of one sort. And the mind is just a kind of place where mental activities of all different kinds happen. Imagining, thinking, feeling sad, anything that has a kind of conscious feel to it is a kind of activity of mind. Aquinas breaks up this flat mind into a bunch of different cognitive powers. And so what you get is a picture, a kind of tri-level picture of mind. It's where you have an array of exterior senses that are picking up the properties of the physical world. your sight, hearing, picking up color, sound. Then you have a kind of basket of internal senses which are involved in organizing or detecting patterns within those, the sort of raw feel of the sensory world. And then the very highest cognitive power that you have, the most noble cognitive power, is the intellect. And the intellect is the power that's responsible for grasping the essences of things. So if you're walking through the park and you see a tree and you've studied botany and you recognize that's an oak tree, right? You're having a coordinated, an experience that's composed of the coordinated activities of all of those powers. You're registering the sensory data, the color and the shape and the texture and the sound, but you're also detecting in the experience the essence of that thing. You know how to classify it relative to those other things. And so that part of your experience is to be able to map classifying schemes in the world of experience. That's what intellect does for you. And for Aquinas, he thinks that all cognition is to some extent immaterial, but intellect is most immaterial. And we could talk all evening about what it would mean to say that something is to some extent immaterial. That sounds very weird to us, from a perspective. So we're not going to talk about those lower levels. We're just going to talk about the more straightforward one, which is intellect, which is purely immaterial. So. All right. So here's what's distinctive about the self-manifesting view of immateriality, is it may be the very place where it starts. It starts by asking us to think differently about what mind is in the first place and what mental activities are, here, intellectual activities. I think it's easy for us to sort of imagine mind, intellect, imagination as mechanisms, little cognitive mechanisms of some sort that project consciousness forward. And that's our conscious experience, is consciousness, but there's something else that's making consciousness happen in the background. Aquinas does not give us that kind of picture of mind. What he gives us instead is a picture of mind as a kind of being, like other kinds of being. And what that means is that we're going to have to spend a few minutes just talking about what this language of kinds of being is supposed to mean and what it would mean to talk about the mind in this very different way as a kind of being that transforms us. So as Aquinas understands change, every change can be analyzed in terms of the subject acquiring a new kind of being. So if you get a sunburn, your skin becomes red, your skin has acquired the being of redness in Aquinas' vocabulary, right? You put a pot of water on to cook spaghetti, the water gets hot, it has acquired the being of heat. So anytime there's any sort of change, there's some subject that acquires a new kind of being. And sometimes in order to acquire those beings, you have that new kind of being, the thing has to lose something else. So the water loses the being of cold and acquires the being of heat. This is how he talks about change metaphysically. And we become acquainted with different kinds of being, and we can distinguish them from each other because of our encounters with the things that have those kinds of being. So for instance, what about the kind of being that is materiality for Aquinas? How do we encounter that? Well, Aquinas says we encounter it because materiality is extended, right? And we trip over extended things. We bump into them, we climb over them, we walk around them, right? It's by engaging with the things that have extended being that we come to have a concept of materiality in the first place. That's where the concept of materiality comes from. So he doesn't worry, for instance, that materiality is some unknown weird reality hiding behind extension, which is how it shows up. Rather, extendedness in three dimensions is the characteristic of material being. And when I stumble over an extended body, that is my experience of materiality. So we can say the same thing of our encounters with other kinds of being. If I feel a temperature increase by holding my hand near a fire, that's an experience of a certain kind of being. Heat, watching a knife slicing through a piece of cheese, that is my experience of sharpness. Right, so we encounter these kinds of beings by observing the things that have those beings. All right, so we've listed a few kinds of being that we stumble across in our trek through reality, like sharpness or extension or heat. So then we might ask the question, what about the mind? Do we stumble across mental being anywhere? Or more specifically, do we stumble across intellectual being anywhere? Because we're using the language of intellect right now. And Aquinas says, yes, we do. We stumble across the intellect whenever we're thinking about anything at all. That's our experience of it. So here's what he writes. He says, the mind understands itself whenever it understands something. And whoever understands or is illuminated knows that he understands or is illuminated. Because he knows the thing to be manifest to himself. What is going on with that? Aquinas is referring here, I would argue, to a phenomenon more familiarly known as implicit self-awareness. Because here's how that would go. So imagine that I'm working at my desk, and lo and behold, suddenly I see a spider climbing up the leg of the desk. And I just freeze in terror and fascination at the sight of this spider. And I might say all of my concentration powers are now focused in on this spider. And I think, what a terrible, terrible creature this thing must be. Now, we might think that I was so focused on the spider at this moment that there was no room left for any kind of self-consciousness. The spider just sucks away all of the possibility of consciousness of anything else in that moment. But that turns out not to be true. I was, in fact, self-conscious even while I was totally focused on the spider. And how do we know that's true? Because if somebody comes into the room afterwards and asks me, what were you just looking at right now? They formulated in these personal terms. I can answer that question in a first personal term, right? I can say, I was looking at a spider. And when I say that, it doesn't feel like I made a discovery. Whoa, I was involved in that somehow, right? I'm just relaying what I already know. I was looking at a spider. So the presence of me to myself was somehow bound up in that very experience that I was already having, even though it wasn't the thing that I was focusing on. So I am always there as a kind of condition for a part of the experiencing of anything else. Otherwise, I wouldn't be able to experience it because I wouldn't be able to experience it as manifest to me. So this is a fundamental idea in Aquinas' theory of self-knowledge. So we might ask ourselves then, if the intellect experiences itself whenever it's experiencing something at all, why does this happen? What's the explanation of this? This is where we get to the more technical stuff. But again, I think this is pretty cool. Let's see if we can lay it all out. So the reason, according to Aquinas, is encapsulated in two fundamental claims. So first, when we're thinking, we're acquiring a new kind of being that we did not have before, just in the same way that the water in the pot acquires the being of heat. What have I acquired when I'm thinking about the spider? I've acquired the being of thought. That's a kind of being. So in other words, my consciousness of the spider is a new kind of being in me. And here I might say, Aquinas, hold on here. Consciousness is something other than being. If we're talking about being, we're talking about things. Consciousness is something else. It's an experience. It's a phenomenon. It's not really something real. We tend to make this distinction, right, between what something being real and out there versus just something in my mind. We tend to treat the mind as less real somehow. And that's exactly where Aquinas wants to challenge us. He thinks that the mental, the intellectual, but all of the mental, counts metaphysically. It's a kind of being. Consciousness is a kind of being. So he thinks if there's any change in the world, it has to be a change in being. And something happens to me when I'm having that episode of consciousness. That's a real change, and that is the acquisition of a new kind of being. So something new is in me. Spider thought. Right? Now, secondly, this new kind of being that has taken up residence in me, it's a disturbing thought, spider thought has taken up residence in me, is a rather surprising kind of being, according to Aquinas. He says that it has two special essential characteristics. It's both intellectual and intelligible. So I've got a quote on the handout where he lays this out. This is the quote from the Summa Contra Gentiles 151. about two-thirds of the way down. He says, the actual intelligible is the actual intellect. But according as intelligible and intellect are distinct from each other, both are in potency, just as is clear in the case of sense. For neither is sight actually seeing, nor is the visible actually seen, except when sight is informed by the visible species, so that from sight and the visible there comes to be something one. This coming to be is very serious language. So what's Aquinas claiming here? He's saying that spider thought, this being that I acquire, has this twofold character. It is intellectual being, and it is intelligible being. Now, intellectual being is the knowing kind of being. An intelligible being is the being known kind of being. And what Aquinas is telling us here is that they're one and the same thing. The knowing kind of being and the being known kind of being are one and the same kind of being. They're just two sides of the same coin. Here's another passage where he lays this out. This is from his commentary on the Metaphysics, 12:8. He says, Aristotle says that it belongs to the nature of the intellect that it should understand itself insofar as it takes on or conceives in itself something intelligible, for the intellect becomes intelligible by attaining something intelligible. And therefore, because the intellect becomes intelligible in conceiving something intelligible, it follows that intellect and intelligible are the same. And he explains how the intellect attains the intelligible. The intellect is related to the intelligible as potency to act and the perfectible to its perfection. And just as the perfectible is receptive of its perfection, so too the intellect is receptive of its intelligible. We could unpack that for a very long time. But the basic idea might easily escape us because we're used to a kind of relational paradigm of knowing where we think of the knower as over here and the object is over there, and knowing is a kind of link established between a subject and an object, right? And so we expect that what makes something be a mind is its ability to be put into the right kind of relationship with the object, and maybe consciousness consists in that relationship or something like that. But Aquinas is working from an entirely different paradigm. For Aquinas, intellectuality cannot be separated from intelligibility. They're just one single thing. Here's one way of putting it. There is no thought that is not also a thinker. And there is no thinker that is not also a thought. Right? So to say that something's intelligible is not to describe some object out there in relation to some possible thinker, but rather to describe a kind of being that is manifesting itself. And Aquinas' key idea here, I think, is that the being that manifests itself is necessarily, at the same time, the one to whom it is manifest. So there's just one kind of being that is manifesting and being manifest to, that is intelligible and intellect. And we can call this kind of being self-manifesting being. We naturally have a potential to acquire self-manifesting being. And when we have it, we are thinking. Indeed, it just is our very experience of thinking. There's some texts where Aquinas lays this out, but I'm not going to read them out here, but you can look at them yourselves. So let's see how this applies to my petrifying experience of the spider. For Aquinas, if I'm watching the spider and thinking about what spiders are with some sort of understanding, intellectual understanding, that means that a new kind of being, a spidery kind of being, has taken up residence in me. But more specifically, it's a spidery kind of being that is both intelligible, known spider being, and intellectual, knowing spider being. To put it another way, I know spiders in virtue of becoming spiderified, namely by acquiring a spidery, self-manifesting being. It's a very metaphysical way to approach this. So Aquinas would explain my knowing of spiders and my knowing of myself at the same time as the result of my having, not the result, but consisting in my acquiring a kind of being that is an episode of spidery self-manifestation, if that makes sense. And this new being that exists in me can be considered from two aspects, intellect-knowing spider, or really me-knowing spider, and spider-known by me. And I think it's really important to emphasize here that for Aquinas, self-manifesting being is a real kind of being in the world alongside being caught, being human, being extended, being fragile, etc., etc. So Aquinas is resisting the tendency to treat the mental as not counting metaphysically, the tendency that we exhibit when we talk about mere experience or only in the mind, as though experience has no ontological status in its own right. And we notice that the implications of positing this kind of being in the natural world run much deeper than merely explaining why I'm implicitly self-aware whenever I think of anything at all. Self-manifesting being is supposed to explain not only why I become aware of myself when I'm aware of anything, but why anything is intellectually manifest to me at all. Spiders can only become known if spiderness acquires self-manifesting being in me or someone else. We could put this more provocatively. Spiderness only becomes manifest to itself as an actuality of my or someone else's intellectual potency. Charles Kahn seems to have something like this in mind when he suggests that for Aristotle, the self-awareness of intellect just is the formal structure of the universe become aware of itself. The human knower is the place of form, which is the place where the self-consciousness of reality happens. That's what we do. So at this point, you might be thinking, maybe we better just go back to the spooky bodies. Might be preferable. But the essentials of the view I'm describing can be summarized in a much more domesticated way. So you just lay out the key ideas here in summary. So first of all, there's a kind of being that is manifest to itself, or self-manifesting, that's intellectual being. Secondly, I encounter it whenever I'm thinking, insofar as I'm self-aware whenever I think. So I asked at the beginning of this section of the paper, do we stumble across the mind anywhere, or the intellect anywhere? Do we have any concrete experiences of intellectual being? And Aquinas' answer is yes, of course we do. Whenever you're thinking, the very thinking itself is the experience of intellectual being. Right? So we don't stumble across it from the outside, but rather my encounter with it is just it manifesting to itself to me in the first person. Third, self-manifestation is not a phenomenal sheen or appearance behind which the real intellect resides. Rather, the intellectual being I acquire when I think, whether intellectual spiderness or anything else, is essentially self-manifesting all the way down. That's a way of resisting the distinction between the subjective and the objective characteristics of thought, if that's a distinction that you're familiar with. Fourth, anything that has this sort of being must be manifest to itself, and since we're only sometimes manifest to itself, namely ourselves, namely when we're actually thinking about something, that means we only sometimes have intellectual being, namely when we're thinking about Pythagorean theorem or spiderness or whatever else. And that's a conclusion that Aquinas happily accepts. Okay, so let's return to our question, is the mind immaterial, and think about it, what that question might look like if we take this notion of self-manifesting being as a kind of starting point instead of the spooky body view. We see right away that the question has a very different force, and the reason is this. So recall that from the spooky body view, when we ask the question, is mind immaterial, we started from the following position. A, we didn't know what the mind is, what kind of being it has. And B, we already had some sort of positive concept of immateriality as the thing that has the stuff that has these spooky properties. So the question then amounted to our asking, what kind of being should we ascribe to the mind? The kind that is familiar from experience, or this other kind of weird spooky being that we've never experienced, but we need it to fill an explanatory gap? We see that Aquinas does exactly the opposite. He starts from the following position, the opposite position. A, he would argue, we already know from experience what kind of being the intellect has. It has self-manifesting being. We know this from experience because every time we think, we're experiencing it. It's experiencing itself in us. And B, his concept of immateriality is a negative concept. So regarding A, remember that in reflecting on the being of mind, we started from an ordinary experience of implicit self-awareness. This is just a common experience that people have. In the act of knowing, I'm aware of myself as the one who's doing the knowing. And this implicit self-awareness is just my experience of self-manifesting being, just as in tripping over a chair, that's my experience of extended being or material being. So intellectual or self-manifesting being on this view is just one of the ordinary kinds of beings that we do experience in the course of going about reality. It is not a distinct, weird kind of being so different from what we're familiar with as to go into a fundamentally different category of being. We already know what it's like. It's part of what we experience. Now, regarding B, Aquinas maintains a purely negative concept of immateriality, and what that means is that the word immaterial for Aquinas means nothing more or less than not material. It doesn't have all sorts of extra properties loaded into it. It just means the kind of being that is not extended for Aquinas. That is it. Right? So from this position, when Aquinas asks, is the mind material or immaterial, here's what he's really asking. Where does this familiar kind of being, self-manifesting being, fit in the taxonomy of all the different kinds of being in reality? Is it a kind of subclass of extended being? Or is it something that fits in a class that's not extended? Right? So we end up not with familiar, spooky, we end up with familiar, one is extended and not self-manifesting, the other is self-manifesting and not extended. That's all it means to say that the mind is immaterial for Aquinas, is simply to say this familiar kind of thing is not extended. Okay, so by analogy, imagine an entomologist who asks at the end of a multi-year study of the black widow spider, I'm not sure why anyone would do this, but perhaps someone would, are these spider behaviors that I've been observing, are they non-rational behaviors or are they rational behaviors? If the entomologist says, they're non-rational behaviors, that's not because she's attributing to them some extra properties, right, spooky non-rationality. It's just to say that the spider behaviors that she's observed belong in a different category from rational behaviors. And to justify making a claim like that, we would expect that the entomologist should show that these two familiar kinds of behavior, spider behavior and rational behavior, are for some reason incompatible with each other. That would be the justification for putting them in two different classes. And similarly, in arguing for the immateriality of self-manifesting being, Aquinas just has to show that these two empirically familiar kinds of being, self-manifesting and extended, are incompatible for each other. So he's not looking for explanatory insufficiency. It has nothing to do with the argument for him. He's just looking at the compatibility of these two kinds of properties. Okay, so I promise that we conclude by mentioning a little bit about why Aquinas thinks that therefore self-manifesting being can't be extended. So here's how he argues, and I have the text there, I think, on the handout, but I'll just tell you how the argument goes, and you can read the text yourself in the interest of time. So the argument in this that he lays out in the text in broad stroke, he only makes this argument twice in his corpus. I think it's actually his most interesting argument for the materiality of intellect. But maybe that's just because I love self-knowledge, and this is a self-knowledge-y sort of argument. So the first, X is self-manifesting if and only if it appropriates itself whole by whole. No extended substance can appropriate itself whole by whole since the parts get in the way. 3, therefore no extended substance can be a self-manifesting being. They're exclusive properties. So the idea is something like this. Self-manifestation implies the presence of the whole to the whole through and through. Or to put it another way, the whole of self-manifesting being must be at once knower and known through and through. If one part is knower and the other part is known, it won't be a genuine self-manifestation, right? Because then any kind of manifestation would be of one part to the other part, right? Yeah, it would come through as it in the third person, not as I. It wouldn't be self-manifestation. But since anything extended is divisible into parts, and no two parts can exist in the same, extended parts can exist in the same place, it's impossible for an extended whole to reappropriate the entire whole. The extension of the parts gets in the way. So for instance, what Aquinas might have something like this in mind. If you imagine a piece of paper that you say, I want this paper to return upon itself, to appropriate itself. You might just start folding it in half, hoping that you can get the paper to appropriate itself by folding it in increasingly. Well, every time you fold it, the top half will make physical contact with the bottom half. And you fold it again, and the right half makes physical contact with the left half, right? But no matter how many times I fold it, you're never going to get the whole paper in contact with the whole paper, right? This is the idea. That's because two extended parts cannot occupy the same spatial temporal position. It's not anything to do with paper as such. It's a problem with the nature of spatial temporal extension. The parts just exclude each other. I can juxtapose them, but I can't make them share the same spatial temporal location. So what that means for Aquinas is that a corporeal being is incapable of reflexive activity because it can never wholly reappropriate itself. So we see that, remember when we learned about extension by stumbling over things, and we always did that from the outside. That's because material objects are only approachable by other material objects from the outside, right? Because their extension puts up opposition to other extended things. But if we're talking about self-manifestation, the rules are totally different. What is self-manifesting is appropriating itself whole by whole from the inside, right? And so Aquinas' idea is that means that self-manifestation and extension in three dimensions are incompatible properties, and that's exactly what's going to lead him then to say that self-manifesting being is immaterial. It doesn't belong in the same class of being as the extended things. Okay. And Aquinas underscores this point in a rare moment of fun in which he proposes a quirky thought experiment. And this is my favorite text in the entire corpus, so I had to put it on the handout here. He says, if a box were to subsist by itself without matter, it would be self-understanding. For freedom from matter implies self-understanding. And hence, an immaterial box would be the same as an intelligible box. And so, in other words, if you had an immaterial box, it would be a self-manifesting box. That means there would be no thinking outside the box, there would be no thinking inside the box, there would just be a self-thinking box. That's it. Maybe we could call it a case of self-awareness. So in conclusion, let me conclude by drawing attention to the three features of Aquinas' self-manifestation approach to immateriality, which differ from the three features of the spooky body approach mentioned earlier, which I think make its conceptualization of immateriality considerably easier to swallow. So first, the spooky body concept began from our experience of material things and then hypothesized what kinds of properties an immaterial thing might have. In contrast, the self-manifestation view starts from our experience of knowing itself as a real kind of being with properties that we experience from the first-person perspective. Secondly, the spooky body concept includes spooky properties that are posited in order to account for the phenomena but are not part of our experience. In contrast, the self-manifestation model doesn't attribute to material being any properties that go beyond our experiencing of exercising intellectual life. The whole content of this concept of immateriality is nothing more than intellectual life as we experience it by living it. Third, the spooky body concept of immateriality is applicable to things that are not minds. In contrast, on Aquinas' view, immateriality is conceptualized as essentially cognitive or mental. Whatever is immaterial is manifest to itself all the way down through and through. As a result, on this view, there's no differentiation between thought and its content, or mind and idea, or mind and a mental state, or mind and an activity. It just is self-manifestation all the way through. So by way of indicating how far this theory of immateriality could take us, let me close with a thought about self-thinking thought. So Nicholas Lash has objected that dualism implies that God, dualism by which he means there being material realities and immaterial realities, implies that God is either a kind of mental event, a thought rather than a thinker, or that he is of the same order as the entities investigated by students of the paranormal. For the consistent dualist, God is either an idea or a ghost. And I suppose the upshot of Aquinas' self-manifestation view is that an immaterial God turns out to be an idea after all, but not Lash's dead thinkerless idea, but rather the living thinking idea intellect of the self-manifestation view, and not just an idea intellect that is manifest to itself through and through, but one which is just sheer self-manifestation. And that's how Aquinas describes God in a really epic passage where he says, God is ipsum intelligere subsisting, pure subsisting, self-manifesting understanding. Thank you.